Good evening and welcome to The Final Draft, where we talk books and writing for 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor.
And I'm Netta Vanavak. And this week we're talking about home and who we are, which is fitting really because this week is also Supporter Drive and we'd like to share with you who we are here at 2SER and fill you in on some of the things that have been going on at the station.
Believe it or not, 2SER has the most diverse content of any radio station in Sydney. With over 100 interviews a week, we've heard from and questioned academics, politicians, musicians, writers, artists and filmmakers, just to name a few.
And if you've been enjoying some of the conversations we've had on Final Draft this year, we'd love you to consider helping to keep us on air. And before we get to our interviews this week, let me just say that all supporters over the next 2 weeks go into the major prize draw to win a year's worth of entertainment, including a Belvoir Theatre season pass, 12 months of movies from Palace Cinemas, a year's worth of gigs from The Basement, 4 CDs a month for a whole year from Inertia, and 2 DVDs a month from Hopscotch, and an OXO digital radio to tune into 2SER loud and clear all year long.
The concession annual rate is only $35, or $70 for a standard, $150 for passionate supporters, and $600 for lifetime sponsorship, which will get you either 50 CDs of the best new music from last year, or tickets for you and a friend to Pete's Ridge Music Festival to celebrate New Year's Eve, with camping included for 3 days.
So if you like us, help support community radio and call us now on 9514 9500.
Now on the show tonight, we have two very special interviews for you, talking about Australia now and then. Netta met up with Melbourne author Toni Jordan when she was recently in Sydney to talk about 9 Days, her sweeping family saga that traces the chaotic pre-war era in 1939 up to present day.
And Una Budarat caught up with political commentator Tin Sutphommasane to hear why multiculturalism in Australia today is succeeding despite the recent riots and ethnic tensions. His book is Don't Go Back to Where You Came From. Both of those coming up, so stay with us.
It's live, it's blue, it's the 2SER website. Log on to www.2ser.com for program guides, radio info, events, special offers, discounts and freebies. While you're there, show your support by subscribing online. And with live streaming, you can listen anywhere in the world. That's www.2ser.com. Designed by Digital Eskimo. 2SER. Real radio.
It's 1939 and Australia is about to go to war. In working class Melbourne, teenaged Kip Westaway is having the most important day of his life.
And that day is one of 9 that will set the course for each member of the Westaway family in the years that follow. From Kip's mother, his twin brother Francis, Kip's wife and their daughters and grandson. All of them live their turning points, triumphs and tragedies through a single day each, spanning some 60 years.
But the idea for the book, novelist Toni Jordan told me, hinges entirely on an archive photograph taken just before the war.
It's a troop train leaving a station in World War II, and there's a soldier leaning out of a window of the train and he's reaching down to kiss a girl who is being held up on the shoulders of someone else on the platform. And they're about maybe 30 centimetres away. They're almost kissing, they're not quite. So it's this very evocative and romantic photo.
And how did you come across it?
Actually, my publisher gave it to me. I had no ideas whatsoever at the end of my second book, finishing my second book. And he rang me, as publishers are wont to do, and said, so book 3, how's it coming? What have you got? And I had nothing. You know, I find ideas just incredibly difficult to come by. And he said, I have this photograph that I've kept for a long time. I've always dreamed of publishing a book with it on the jacket. Would you take a look at it? And it sort of began from there.
Does he have like a little stockpile of photos that he presses upon reluctant writers?
There might be an ideas file or something like that in the filing cabinet. I'm really grateful for that kind of idea because I wrote my first novel in a creative writing class, and writing prompts and being in a group of people who understand your process and that you can bounce ideas off, I think is one of the more enjoyable parts of the job. So I'm delighted when someone gives me a suggestion.
But with something like that, I mean, how much do you want the freedom to develop the story yourself, and how much are you desperate to look up the historical background and to find out who they were and what happened to them?
Yeah, well, that was a bit of a concern of mine because I didn't know who they were, and also I felt a little responsible for the image as he'd given it to me. And the novel that I wrote ended up quite different from the what the picture might lead you to believe.
It was very much not my expectation to have it pan out the way that it did.
Yeah, it's kind of a family saga. It's four generations. So a good third of the book is set in reasonably contemporary times. And it's all these different voices, nine different first-person voices. So we visit the nine members of these of this family on the single most important day of their life.
So. The picture kind of, it's almost like a bookend in a way for me, coming as it does at the beginning of the war with that other very famous photo in Times Square of the sailor kissing the nurse at the end of the war. And the two of them are really beautiful, and I feel like they kind of speak to each other in a really lovely way of that
era. Yeah, they do. And that Times Square photo, I think, made it even more important to me that I wrote this book about an Australian image, because that is kind of our iconic memory of part of those times. And I think it's right that we should have a closer to home image that also sums it up. And now that it's been published, a lot of people have come forward, and a number of people have said they think it's actually a Sydney photograph, a photograph taken in Sydney, because at the front of the book is a sleeve of a policeman on the platform, and they say that's a New South Wales police uniform, and the carriage itself is a New South Wales.
So had you assumed
carriage.
That it was Melbourne?
I had, because it was originally in the State Library of Victoria.
Oh, okay.
But I'm thinking that's not the case now. And I've been extensively through those records of newspapers at the time. I can't find it ever having been published. So now I'm thinking perhaps it was a photo taken from an early troop movement in Sydney and sent down to be published in the Victorian papers.
So writing this has sort of made an historian of you.
It's very interesting, and writing historical fiction is just incredibly difficult. And I like to tell myself that it's because that period, the 30s and 40s, is still within some kind of living memory. So if I stuffed it up really badly, someone would know.
So is that better or worse for a writer?
I think it's worse. I think it's worse. If I was actually, you know, in the 1600s, who would be around to say that that's not how it was?
You get a lot more creative license.
That's right. I'm conscious about always trying to keep the reader in the story and having no instance where anyone raises their eyes from the book and say that doesn't sound right. So I really worked very hard to try and prevent that happening.
Which is really remarkable considering, like you say, that you have nine characters from two teenage boys. Two and a half. to women at various ages and stages in their lives across, you know, a half century. How do you go about piecing together a story like that?
Well, the teenage boys actually gave me the most worry because I have no children. And I have no boys of any description in my life, and I never have. I have no brothers. I went to a girls' school, a convent school. So the amount of boys in my life has been close to nil. So that was really the voice that caused me the most concern.
It's interesting that you say that, because they're, to me, the most alive, really. Like, they leap off the page.
Thank you.
From the very first story with Kip. You know, by the time you finish that chapter and he's gone, and you just think, but where has he gone?
Oh, that's
Is he coming back?
Thank you. Yeah, I was a really obnoxious teenager myself, and that's quite 30-something years ago, but I was had enough memories of my obnoxiousness so that I could draw on that, especially for the last teenager, Alec, the modern-day teenager.
Obnoxiousness isn't unique to girls.
No, no, I think it's a cross-gender condition of the teenage years. So Alec is not anywhere near as obnoxious as I was. I was much, much worse.
Frances is pretty bad.
Yeah, Frances is not. Frances and Jean, actually the mother of the boys, I had to work the hardest on, I think, because it took me a while to find some compassion for them.
With each of the stories, you're looking at the family through a different prism. You know, you're seeing yet another element of their lives. And Jean is not very sympathetic, and yet you do have great sympathy for her, being, you know, a single mother at that time. And, you know, with an unwed daughter who gets into trouble and everything that she's contending with, it's a lot.
Yeah, I'm so pleased that you saw that. The first draft was not like that. I mean, I found her really difficult.
How did you conjure some compassion for her?
Well, it's really hard. And I suppose this is the beautiful part of fiction, isn't it? It's about, for a short time, seeing the world through someone else's eyes, and it's about immersing yourself in that person's background and concerns and trying to understand why they behave the way they do, and that kind of empathy that comes sometimes with the most difficult characters. I mean, some characters are easy to like. They don't require that much work, but the ones that do require a lot of work are sometimes the more rewarding, because you're learning you know, to be a bit more understanding of other people.
So did you have a greater feeling of satisfaction then when you finished those chapters?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think I'm glad that you saw her with some compassion, but there was certainly the biggest shift between my first draft and the finished book in those chapters.
Did you have a timeline that you'd mapped out before you started writing, or did you have, I mean, because it's a very tightly structured book in terms of the time frame.
It is.
How do you even go about piecing that together?
I actually did all that at the end. I sat down and wrote it beginning to end in the form that it is, and I knew I wanted, you know, a reasonable mix between men and women and between the different time periods. But at the end, I was really concerned that the days, because everybody only gets one day, and I wanted that one day to be real. So in the end, I then sat down and made kind of a chart of this day, what day of the week was it, what season, what was the actual date, how old was everybody at that time. But I very much did that after the event, after I'd written the first draft.
And then did you find yourself needing to weave in extra details so there'd be some sort of linear flow?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm. But that's why I think the research was much easier for me, because I kind of retrofitted it. I figured out what I needed to know, and then
that's
I went
very
out.
Very convenient.
And, yeah, it was much. I've heard stories of people who write historical fiction who just get lost in the research for months and sometimes years before they write the book. So I'm glad that. It sounds like I planned it that way, but actually that's just the way it happened. But I think it's an efficient way to do it.
So you weren't then immersing yourself in 1930s Melbourne in any concrete way? You were just kind of cherry picking?
Yeah, I was cherry picking, but I was really immersing myself in the characters. And I've never had this experience before with fiction where twice. Normally I keep normal hours. I try and treat it like a normal job. But twice, you know, my husband was going to bed at 10:30 or 11, and I said, I'm just going to sit at the computer just for 10 minutes, just to play with a sentence that's not working. And then the next thing I knew, on two occasions, he was getting up. And I'm like, can't you sleep? And he said, it's 6 o'clock.
And you just worked through the
Yeah,
night.
And I just didn't even notice it. So I found being in the world of these people, I think it's more like method acting, really, first-person fiction, because the battle is pretending you are that person, pretending you are a widow with three children in 1939, and how does the world seem to you? And once you've done that sort of imaginative work, the rest of it, for me, is not difficult. I can then know what they're going to say and hear how they speak it and see the things that concern them.
That was Toni Jordan talking about her third novel, 9 Days.
Here's the money we all pitched in.
You won't regret this purchase.
There are a lot of crap options you can spend your dosh on, but why not invest in something real and a real alternative? 2SER. Subscribing to 2SER costs relatively little and helps us keep on keeping on. You'll make your money back with our giveaways and discounts all over town, which makes 2SER a sound investment. Go online to 2SER.com and subscribe to Real Radio.
You're listening to Final Draft on 2SER, and as you're hearing, it's Supporter Drive here this week. We're asking you to help keep us on air for another year of quality community radio. Supporter rates range from $35 for concession to $600 for lifetime lovers of excellent radio.
Every single supporter receives a 2SER keyring, a Spunk Records compilation featuring Ty Siegel, M. Ward, Henry Wagons, Yaysayer, Bear Hug, and much, much more. For our passionate supporters, which is only a mere $150, you'll also get a limited number of Sony headphones along with those lovely 2SER t-shirts.
They were designed by a UTS visual communications student as part of a competition we ran earlier this year. They come in black or white, and the design is a drawing of an old school radio. If $150 is stretching the bank but you'd still like a shirt, you could also buy one for $30, all the proceeds of which go towards keeping the station on air. Give us a ring now and help us out on 9514 9500.
This year we've been pushing innovative young artists from around the world. We've held 12 months worth of free performances live at the Loft, and you might not have known that we've also held training courses for hundreds of students and others, including people with special needs who want to tell their stories on radio.
So if you've been enjoying those stories, show your love for 2SER by pledging your support. That number is 9514 9500.
I love cinema.
I love thunder and rain and soccer.
I love photography. Photography is fun. I love the way it shows you familiar things with a totally different perspective.
I love the music at 2SER.
Share the love.
Support real radio. Call 9514 9500 or go to 2ser.com.
And that was the Cactus Channel there with their track Tom Has Ideas from their album Haptics, which is also a 2SER Album of the Week.
Support 2SER between October 15 and 27 and you could win a whole year's worth of entertainment. A standard subscription is only $70. We'll share the love with a gift for every supporter. Authorised under New South Wales permit number LTPS-12-08100.
The recent violent protests in Sydney have raised questions about the effectiveness of multiculturalism. European governments are declaring it a failure, and conservatives in Australia agree. We've seen regular Australians and celebrities struggle publicly on TV when faced with living the life of migrants and asylum seekers so far from home.
But maybe it's not a failure. In his book, Don't Go Back to Where You Came From, Tim Sutpomasan, political philosopher and lecturer at Monash University, reckons that multiculturalism in Australia has been a success. He speaks with Una Budarak.
Well, there's certainly a very big international debate about whether multiculturalism works. In Europe, you have a large body of opinion that thinks that it's failed. And those debates have influenced the debate here in Australia as well. So you have no shortage of commentators claiming that there's a crisis of Australian multiculturalism and that social fragmentation is the inevitable result of any official endorsement. Most recently, you've seen this emerge once again following the protests by Muslim youths in Sydney. So
yes.
You had commentators such as Greg Sheridan, such as Jared Henderson, such as Andrew Bolt, claiming that we were now bearing the bitter fruit of Australian multiculturalism. And for me, I think it's a bit misguided to draw lessons from the European experience because Australia's had a very distinctive journey of multiculturalism. We've adopted a citizenship model of multiculturalism. What it has meant is that you can express your sense of cultural heritage and identity, but that you express that in the context of an overarching or unifying national identity. What happened in Sydney a number of weeks ago. Now, you can point to that protest conducted by an extreme fringe of the Muslim communities and say that it's representative, or you can point to it and appreciate the response to the protest, to the cooperation that Muslim community leaders and members provided to police afterwards to ensure that there was no repeat. And I think if you weigh it up, what you saw was an illustration of how effective and successful Australian multiculturalism has been. There will always be challenges when it comes to integration. I think of my own background growing up in southwest Sydney. I grew up not far from Cabramatta during the 1980s and 90s, and when I grew up, the place had a reputation for being the drug capital of Australia and for being the hub of Asian crime, and it was a dodgy place. But if you fast forward to today, to a mere two decades after, you find a vastly different Cabramatta. But the moral of the story is that progress happens. Social mobility has been the characteristic feature of our immigrant story, but we tend to focus a bit too much and a bit too unhealthily on the negatives.
But much of the conversation following those protests revolved around the notion that migrants should integrate or assimilate into white Australian society. Are we seeing a resurgence of nationalism in Australia?
For me, a good indication is the embrace of the Australian flag at public events. When Pauline Hanson in 1997, when she launched her One Nation party and draped herself in an Australian flag, I think most of us thought of it as a little silly and a bit tacky. But if you go to a sporting event today, or if you go to an Anzac Day ceremony, you find that young Australians in particular embrace national symbols in an unapologetic way and in a way that previous generations of Australians perhaps didn't. That was certainly one feature of the Cronulla riot in 2005 that I think the vast majority of Australians found troubling. The fact that national symbols were being used by a group of Australians not as symbols of unity, but to exclude people based on their ethnicity, race, or cultural background. I don't think that's a very healthy way to articulate a sense of Australian national identity. At its best, patriotism, a love of country, should be inclusive and should be generous. It should be about ensuring that your country lives up to the best of its traditions rather than excluding people because they don't conform to the majority. My own view is that there doesn't need to be any fundamental conflict between having a multi-ethnic and multicultural society and a healthy national identity. Going back to what I said earlier, because you contain diversity within a clearly articulated set of values.
You attribute the hardening of Australian perceptions of asylum seekers to the Tampa affair in 2001. How has that event shaped our policies and views?
Tampa is certainly a watershed moment. I think what happened there was that refugees or asylum seekers were demonised in a way that captured the public imagination powerfully. You had a climate in 2001 in which Australians had a very genuine concern about terrorism and asylum seekers, and terrorism became linked to some extent in the public mind. We've had a very unedifying debate about this, one in which asylum seekers aren't necessarily considered as human beings and as people fleeing from persecution in their homelands. Let's not forget that the vast majority of people who arrive in Australia by boat end up having their asylum claims recognised. If you alienate people the moment they arrive in a country and they have nowhere else to go, that's not necessarily a good recipe for integration and for good citizenship later down the track. And we shouldn't underestimate just how much of a work in progress our multicultural society is. If we don't work hard at maintaining it, it can quickly crumble.
What do new cultures bring to a society, or from, I guess, a cynical vantage, why should we defend a multicultural Australia?
Well, we can go through the different benefits of diversity. You can mm-hmm. look at the economic benefits of diversity. A big body of academic research and economic research that shows the contributions that immigrants make to an economy. It's not just about the economy either. A country benefits from immigration because it adds vitality and energy to a place. If you go to a country that doesn't grow, that doesn't take in new people, you can end up with a stifling culture. And let's not forget, we live in a global world where there is a good deal of exchange when it comes to ideas, innovations, technology, and not least people. A diverse society in a global world is best equipped to take advantage of opportunities. And finally, it's important, just in the context of the so-called Asian century, to remember that Australia doesn't exist in isolation from its immediate region. This notion that we can just turn the clock back and not worry about immigration or go back to what Australia might have been in the 1940s or 50s is entirely misguided. Diversity is here to stay. The question is how we manage diversity, and I think we have a good foundation for managing that with our experience of multiculturalism.
And going forward, what are the future challenges that face multiculturalism in Australia?
Racism is still an issue to contend with. Something between 10 to 15% of Australians report that they have experienced an incidence of racism during the past 12 months. It's a reminder that we have to work hard to ensure that we treat people fairly and allow people to have a go. We know that media portrayals of Australian diversity are not as strong as what they could be. If you look at Australian TV shows, you don't really see the face of ordinary multicultural Australia being represented. And finally, with an Asian century looming before us, there's more that needs to be done to reflect on what we can take out of an Asian century in cultural terms, whether we can reflect on our own values by looking at the experience of our neighbours. And I think that's a real big challenge for multicultural Australia.
That was Una Budarak speaking to Tim Sutpumasun about his new book, Don't Go Back to Where You Came From.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's show. If you did, please consider signing up to show us some love this week during Subscriber Drive. You can chat to one of our very friendly volunteers on 9514 9500. Every single subscriber gets a prize.
And you also go into the major prize draw to win a whole year's worth of entertainment. With Belvoir Theatre tickets, CDs from Inertia, Gigs at the Basement, Hopscotch DVDs, Palace Cinema tickets and an Ox Digital Radio.
There's also brand new 2SER t-shirts, Sony headphones and Pete's Ridge Festival tickets up for grabs. And you go into the daily prize draw to win a Shade D fresh food hamper. So please share the love and help us keep bringing you awesome independent radio.
Next week, we'll be talking to Louis Naura about his new book of animal children and thylacines as we dip back into Tasmania in the 1880s.
That's Monday at 7. Until next week.
I love people with red hair. They need it more than most.
No, that's fine.
I love pleasantness.
I love Robbie's hair.
Yeah, that's what I love about 2SER.
Share the love. Support Real Radio. Call 9514 9500 or go to 2SER.com.